What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Be The Number. I am your host, Spencer Aguiar, and I'm very excited to be joined this week by John Hasselbauer. You probably know John best by his Twitter handle of PGA Tout, but if this is your first time getting to hear him on a show, you're in for a treat. John is considered one of the most respected individuals inside of this industry, and I've been waiting a long time to be able to team up with him on a project like this. So I don't want to waste a moment of quality time. Let's get right into the show. John, how are you doing, my man?
I am doing well. Thank you for the intro, Spencer. Very excited to be on and honored to be beside you on this telecast, podcast, videocast, whatever we're calling it. I'm so excited for Mayakoba. I've played the course. That there are very few courses, if any, on the regular schedule that I can actually say that. Hopefully that list grows over time, but for now it's just Mayakoba on the schedule. So if there's one event I feel like I should be confident going into it, as confident as one can be handicapping a golf event, it's this one. So I'm excited to talk to you about it.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you on this also. And, you know, one of my goals since getting into this business has been to try and be a trendsetter. I like thinking outside the box. I try to provide tools for others to use, whether that be my database or the various other sources of information I provide. But I take you as somebody who's in that same mold of being revolutionary and different. Many DFS users, sports bettors alike, use your first look preview that you release on Sunday to get a better concept of what to expect for the week ahead, which can be found on your website, www.thepgatout.com. If you could, explain a little to the audience how you got started in this space and what made you create your own website.
Yeah, I think like a lot of the great the new creators in this space, it all started in the pandemic. There's a lot of really great OG guys out here who've been doing this for longer, and I have a ton of respect for those guys because those are the guys who kind of like inspired me to want to do DFS and create it and not consume it anymore. So shout out to the OGs out there. But for me, it was like I was actually originally XFL Tout, which I'm not like an XFL fan, but to your point, like you want to be a trendsetter, you want to get ahead of things. And I had just moved to Jersey City, and they just made sports betting legal in Jersey. And at the time I was living on my own, so I just had all this free time on my hands. And I was like, you know what? Nobody knows what they're doing with XFL. If I spend an hour a day just like trying to figure it out, I'll have an edge. And that's all gambling ever should be. It's just like finding an edge. So I did that. The XFL was a thing for like 3 weeks, and then they canceled it due to COVID. I had an okay following on Twitter as a foundation. I was like, you know what? Maybe there's something here. Golf was the first sport to return. Really first major sport aside from like Russian Premier League soccer, which I also dabbled in for a hot second, to no avail. But yeah, I mean, golf is really my passion. I like to play it. I love watching it. I love talking about it, and I like writing, and I didn't realize how much I would like writing about it until I started. So, I pivoted to PGA Tout in, June 2020. And for the rest of that year, just tweeted cards like a lot of people do. And then, at the end of the year around Christmas time, I was like, you know what? I had a profitable year. I'm going to roll it over. So I rolled it into a Fantasy National subscription, invest in myself. And I figured if I had some success with limited free tools, I could only improve on that with more data. And then to justify it, if I were to have losses while paying for this premium subscription tool, I figured maybe I could create content out of it. So if I'm losing, maybe I could help somebody else win, and then I won't feel like I've wasted money on a subscription tool. So that was really the genesis of the website, just trying to help other people, people who didn't maybe necessarily have the means to subscribe to a database tool like that. It's not too bad though. If you're not a Fantasy National subscriber, I will plug them, not that I'm endorsed to, but you know, it's great. So you should check it out, and they have good promo codes and everything. Anyway, So I've been doing that. Century Tournament of Champions is the first tournament I did a preview article for, and it's been really cool to just see, you know, everything grow over time. It's definitely caught me by surprise how much it's gained traction. So I'm always flattered by the support and happy to be a little piece in this community.
Yeah, I mean, I would say at this point, you're definitely more than a little piece of the community. I mean, your follower count has been just rapid fire in the last year with how quickly that your follower count has been growing with that. And I kind of wish now, I didn't watch the XFL in that little 3 week stint, but I did watch the original XFL when it came out in whatever that was, the early 2000s, I guess. And I actually have a He Hate Me jersey or whatever his name was on that. So for the Las Vegas team, but you know, your start is very similar to mine in the sense that I decided to make a website and cover various sports too, a handful of years ago. I did some AAF football. I was doing NFL, NBA, all that stuff, but the market as a whole has grown exponentially from the days that I first started doing this. As you were saying, I mean, like, it's a completely different industry now. We have a ton of great content creators out there that make gaining an advantage more difficult because the average DFS player is much sharper than they used to be with all the information they can take in and have access to. I usually explain it as the DFS version of what happened inside the poker world when Chris Moneymaker won the main event in 2003. The initial boom always sends a frenzy of newcomers into the space. But the problem is that as the new money slowly siphons its way to the top, many are left in this middle zone where they either need to get better or run the risk of being at too large of a disadvantage to compete. And that's where we see these industries always start pushing towards websites, podcasts, learning tools, and all of that becoming what takes over. So as more states legalize all forms of gambling, it hopefully will continue to let everyone that puts in research have an edge. But as you know, John, you have to be unique and stick to a strategy that you believe in to find success. Doing what everyone else does is a surefire way to rake yourself off a site. So I'd love to hear a little about what a week of handicapping looks like for you from a strategy standpoint.
Yeah, for sure. I think everything that I do is rooted in a strategy to pick an out, right? I do a lot of my research and all of the attention I put into golf is for the entertainment of it. It's not really to build a bankroll. It's not to grind out like a steady week over week small profit. So I don't do a lot of like matchups or replacement bets. It's most fun for me to sweat an outright. It's a much more volatile market, and I would not recommend it if you're trying to build a bankroll. Definitely not. But for me, it's I always call it like the cost of admission. Like I'm paying X amount of dollars, and that gets me interested in an event. And that's no different than if I were to pay for a ticket to go to a football game. You know, similar cost wise, I'm paying for entertainment. That's how I treat sort of gambling. So if I win $0 in a week of golf betting, it's cool. I followed along. I was entertained by the event. I can move on. I learned something. For me, when I get started my process, I think the first thing I do is watch YouTube videos of the previous year's tournament, and I'll watch like what the winner did, highlights of like best shots from that round. That's always available the week before, whatever. And that's just a very easy way to see the course, see how it operates, see the types of shots that you need to hit, and then you kind of have a sense, okay, this is the type of player that's won the last couple of years, whether they're like a bomber or a plotter, get a general sense of that sort of player profile. And then I'll go into data golf. That's always kind of been one of my first stops as a free resource before I was even set up to Fantasy National. And they have great like course fit tools, and you can scroll through, you know, year by year, what the leaderboards look like. And just like before I even know what the field's going to look like, I can kind of expect, you know, who should perform well. And then usually by Friday night, the field is loaded into Fantasy National. So I'll basically export all of the strokes gain categories into an Excel that I have. And from there, I kind of just start to like pivot, make some tables. And what I like to do is sort of whittle down the field so that I can get the player pool to something a little more palatable. As I said, like I'm really only trying to bet like five, six, seven outrights a week. And my DFS player pools are not large, like not more than 15, 20. So for me, it's really important to just whittle down players I know cannot perform well on a given course, a given setup. So I'll like filter top above average stats in this field, or top 100 stats in this field. And if I take my five key categories, and I take above average in those, then I'm usually already at a core of like 20 players from the beginning. So that's just a couple of tactics that I think have helped me, you know, whittle down, make it a little less overwhelming, because these fields are 150 plus. You stare at all of them, all these golfers are so good, it's really hard to differentiate. But if you if you look at the trends, if you look at the correlations from previous events and what the top 20 each year is doing well, I think that's helpful to predict the following year. And I look to the past trends to try to project to the next year and whittle down that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a similar concept of what I'm doing also. I like Data Golf as a source. That's something that I use a little bit of just to see course fits, different percentages of things with it. My process is a little bit different in the sense that I use the PGA Tour website. I run a 2-year model to where I am changing the information to fit a narrative that I believe. So like as the year goes on, I'm adding more of that current year into the mix and less of the past year into it. So, but it's the same concept of like, I'm building a model to try to find the best key stats for an event. I'm using those key stats to then run my model that I release out for the public. I mean, as I always tell everybody, you can make a copy of it, do all of this yourself. You can see what I have with it. But I think the biggest piece of advice I can give is to just find a process that works for you. Taking in a ton of information is definitely a positive, but you have to do it in a manner that doesn't fall into the majority. John's picks will never be exactly the same as mine. My model will never produce the same outputs as a site like Fantasy National. And that's what makes the industry so great is that there are a ton of resources and sites out there to help with your process. I'm a firm believer that rising tides lift all ships. So doing shows like this where you get two sharp but differing ways of going about it to discuss a board usually ends up being my favorite type of podcast to film. I hope everyone listening feels the same way, but I think that's a good segue into the event this week. We have the newly named Worldwide Technology Championship at Mayakoba, El Chameleon Golf Course, a little over 7,000 yards, par 71, past Palm Greens, 132 player field. I know from us speaking off air, and you even mentioned it a little bit earlier, that you've played this venue 3 months ago. So I'm excited to get your viewpoint of the track, but we do run into a few problems from a handicapping perspective. The first is that we have a sample size, the one positive is that we have a sample size of leaderboards that stretch back to 2007. So we aren't at the same disadvantage we were last week where we only had two previous tournaments to look through. I think that played itself out negatively for most because it wasn't a large enough data to derive much from. The basics of that course looked like it would play into the hands of accuracy golfers. That didn't necessarily come to fruition. But I can say with near certainty that the week we are going to get here is going to be more of what we anticipated for the Bermuda. You know, we still have the issue of no stat tracker and a potential for weather bias. But the lack of data should be easier to traverse through because of the concrete interpretation we can grab by looking at some of the common stats. So with that being said, what are you weighing into your research this week? And what did you see from El Chameleon when you played the track?
Yeah, and I think just to piggyback off that first, I think something I did that was lazy last week, that was definitely a learning that I'll take this week, is just looking at the winners and pulling trends from that alone, because usually the winners are the outliers of the week. And they did something extremely good. And maybe they got a really hot putter and it's not representative of who's actually the fit for that course. So last week, you look at Brian Gay, you look at Brendan Todd, two of the most extremely short fairway hitters on tour. And it's just easy to assume it's a fairway track. But you look at that course and it's so forgiving off the tee and you're hitting into wind that actually makes the course a little bit longer. And you can understand why a bomber like a Taylor Pendrith would have success, or even Patrick Rogers. Lucas Herbert, I don't know too much about his game, to be honest. I know he plays well in wind, so maybe there was something more you could find. But as you said, the luxury of this week is that we have so many years, year over year, to look back at least from a player profile standpoint, to just look at who is consistently year over year in that top 10, top 20. And then from there, you can kind of see the trends. So the top year over year players here are Russell Knox, Emiliano Grillo, Aaron Wise even kind of pops to the top. And those are the exact same player to me. The guys who are great ball strikers, really good fairway finders, have a little bit of distance as well, Wise and Grillo at least, but not very good putters. But as we've seen in these sort of island tracks, or really any course that has like very unblemished, smooth greens, it's actually an equalizer for the field. And it's an opportunity for guys who typically lose strokes to kind of play even and maybe have a neutral putting week, which is huge for those types of players. Anytime we're outside of the US, we don't see the strokes gained data. So we're kind of assuming. that they didn't have terrible putting weeks here. But I think that is actually a pretty consistent trend when we look at these great ball strikers, these team no putt guys who are really good tee to green, or at least ball striking, and can never seem to hit putts, that their best results really are on these island courses like a Puerto Rico Open, Mayakoba, Corrales, even Bermuda. Like, something about playing on these mostly past problem greens is a good neutralizer for the poor putter. So I'm not going to play a guy because he's a bad putter. But similar to Zozo, when a lot of people were on Hideki Matsuyama, it's an opportunity for you to not fade a guy because he's a poor putter, I think is how I would put it. And then going into, I guess, segueing into my experiences, I am a very poor putter. So I did not putt well at this course. It's my own fault. I will partially blame the putter itself because I was playing with rentals. I'm a big mallet guy, and it was like a very traditional blade, which is not good for me. I need the head to do all the work if I have any chance. And this was, I was playing with like Tiger Woods putter, which like shouldn't be a problem, but for me, big problem. But you know, these greens are flat. This is not like, we're not at elevation. We're not reading tough like slopes or anything. These are like pretty straightforward greens. There's no grain in past problems, so you don't have to worry about putting up grain, down grain. It's really just what you see is what you get. It's going to roll true. I actually played after a lot of rain. So it might have been a little less smooth than it's going to be in actual tour conditions, but I mean from a putting standpoint, I would expect the poor putters to put a little bit above their benchmark. But also what I think is interesting is that really good putters have had great history here. So when it's not Victor Hovland winning last year, who's sort of an up and down, definitely a below average putter, you look at the list and it's Matt Kuchar, Brendan Todd, Patton Kizzire. These are all putting specialists. And I think where that comes into play is more in like the 20 to 25 foot range, where a really good putter can step over a 20 footer on a smooth green and feel confident that they're going to hit it. And I think the part that neutralizes this to the other end of the spectrum is if you're a poor putter, you're usually going to lose your strokes gained putting within that 5 foot or 7 foot range. And on a smooth green, if you're a little nervy, you know, or just like not confident over the putt, it's going to roll smooth. So I think they're going to hit more of those putts and you're going to lose less strokes that way. So I think from a data standpoint, that's where I'm assuming the playing field is leveled that way. And then I guess the only other thing I would say, it's tight. And I was very reassured when I looked at Data Golf, and Data Golf had the most extreme course pivot. I don't know if you saw this as well, but it was almost literally off the chart of how important driving accuracy is. And I always feel a little more comfortable when we're dealing with any sort of extreme when handicapping an event. If this is the most important driving accuracy week, or this is the shortest course we've ever seen, or this is the longest course we've ever seen, it's easier for me to handicap because then I have a very specific group of players that I know profile well here. And more importantly, I have a very specific group of players that I know cannot do well here. So again, if I go back to the process of whittling down, anybody who's a bomb gouger or a bomber who is not accurate, it just typically doesn't do well in shorter courses, that's an easy fade for me this week.
Yeah, I for, just to backtrack for a second, I love what you said about the putting, and that's one of the things I've been trying to stress on the show, is when you get these greens that are very simple, it's always going to help the people on the polar opposite ends of the spectrum. It's going to take the putters that are really bad and make them better for the exact reason that you mentioned. These are your good ball strikers that are hitting it from, you know, 5 to 10 feet and then aren't making the putt at these other courses. And it's going to take some of these other guys that get these really clean looks that are good putters and they're 20, 25 feet away and they drain a couple more putts like Matt Kuchar or any Brendan Todd, any of the names like that. So I really like what you said with that. I guess the one problem that I have with this tournament, and I agree, I think this is a really good betting tournament, but when you have information like this, I do think it sometimes makes the DraftKings board a little bit worse just because everybody's going to have a similar thought process. Like, as you said, the driving accuracy is in another world on Data Golf. Like, I mean, that is so stretched over. Like, I've never seen something that stretched over before. And that's the problem you run into, is everybody knows that this is going to be an accuracy course, what you need to be looking for. And so you kind of see the ownership start getting stuck in certain areas with it. And even like with the way I built my model, I think it's very similar in the trajectory of that. So I guess that would be the one problem I have from a DFS perspective. But I think you and I are more or less on the same page here. I would say the best way to describe the venue would be as an exposed oceanside track that also features jungle terrain and swampland. That's a unique mixture since you get three different textures with that description. There are very few locations on the PGA Tour where distance doesn't hold an advantage over precision, but nearly 65% of all top 10 finishers during the previous 8 years have been shorter than average off the tee. It's not to say that distance is a negative, but accuracy players will undoubtedly see a boost for all the reasons John and I just said. One of the reasons for that has to do with players clubbing down to avoid the plethora of hazards that come into play. The rough is virtually non-existent, but the misses do compound for the architectural reasons I mentioned above. When you miss to one area, you end up in the jungle. If you're on the other side, you might be in the water. And as you're worrying about all that, the wind that comes into play off the coast only enhances the difficulty. So funny enough, while the scoring is easy for those that find the winner's circle, ranking near the top 10 on tour every season and birdie or better percentage, it also lands in the same range when it comes to double bogey or worse rate. Mistakes will be made when balls get sprayed, and golfers can start to feel as if they are trapped in a tiny bubble once things begin to go in the wrong way with the gusts. The only difference for me, I guess, is I didn't see a ton of off-the-tee data aside from accuracy. Like, I just think with the ability to club down, I'm looking a little bit more for good proximity numbers. Guys that are capable of getting hot with the putter is going to be one way I'm looking at it. I'm also fine looking at the bad putters for the reasons we mentioned. These greens usually come in around 10 to 11 on the stimp meter. The reason they make them so slow is to protect against gusts wreaking havoc on the field. I'm not one that typically weighs a ton of putting into a model, but I do think you can use it as a tiebreaker in a sense for certain players if you're trying to do that. And I do want to note that it sometimes can be a weird tournament because of certain variables. The rollover predictability from year to year is marginal at best, so I'm not going to use a ton of past success at the course to find an advantage. Instead, I would rather find statistical fits or golfers bringing good form with them. I do believe you can use the horse for the course narrative to break close calls once again, but Hovland and Todd both won the event having missed the cut in their previous attempts. So I will very quickly try to run through this from a statistical perspective of what I did put into my model. I started with weighted ball striking for 25%. That is the PGA Tour's definition of the category. I took a majority of the total and turned total driving into an accuracy stat, and then marginally added in GIR percentage to that heavy weighted total driving mark to derive a value there. Weighted proximity for 15%, that encompassed all proximity values, but 60% of the weight came from 0 to 150 yards. The rest I marginally added in. Weighted scoring for 10%. As I noted previously, El Chameleon ranks inside the top 10 in both birdie or better percentage and double bogey or worse rate. With that being said, the winner of the event will be the one that can get to 20 under par or better. So I stuck to positive scoring outputs as more of the weight for that. Weighted par four for 15%. A lot of these holes are going to be your most difficult. So I did come back around on adding a percentage of bogey avoidance. Par five birdie or better for 12.5%. These are reachable in two for the most part. It has been the number one decider between the three par totals in figuring out top 10 finishers over the last few years. Weighted slow to average greens for 12.5%. I considered going more putter heavy, but that stat took a mixture of strokes gained total and putting metrics on slow greens. Some notable top 10 finishers there were Hadwin, Hatton, Matt Jones, Justin Thomas, Matt Kuchar, Seamus Power, Abraham Anser. And I finished with 10% on strokes gained total at courses under 7,200 yards. I considered adding in scoring at easy courses to go along with it, but the mistakes compound at the track, making how someone plays at a shorter track more relevant in my eyes. Plus, I already had scoring in general in the weighted scoring tabs. So I ran that model from an overall rank sense, which included 70% of the stats above and 30% current form. I got a top five of Justin Thomas, Anser, Hovland, Tringali, and Mito. Henley placed seventh, and the biggest notable outlier difference was Chris Kirk at 14th, who comes into the week priced at $6,700. John, I don't know if you want to add anything else to what I just said there, but if not, we can move into the top of the board this week.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that player pool. I agree with what you put in. The only other thing I would add for my model, which I don't usually do, but I did include comp course history because I think there are a decent amount of courses, especially since we don't have the strokes gained data from this course. I think it's just a little nice to throw in a little tee to green from other courses that are sort of angular positional short courses like a Wailea, Harbour Town, or what was the other one I was thinking at? Pebble Beach, even Cocoa Beach, which doesn't have it doesn't have strokes gained data, but it is past Palom, and we've seen a decent overlap. Obviously, Victor Hovland has won a bowl. So I don't always put comp course history into a model, but this week, since we're kind of limited on exactly what strokes gained we can reference, I think it's important to you know, feed that in for myself.
Yeah, I kind of like that route better, going the comp course route rather than what players have done on this course. I know that's kind of weird to say, and maybe it's because we don't have the strokes gained data here to get the full picture of it, but there isn't like the greatest rollover predictability. You do have certain guys that play it all the time well, but it's been hit and miss for some of these players. So I like the comp course route with it. I think that's a unique way to try to get a little bit more weight into it in a different sense. But we have seven players this week priced above $10,000. Justin Thomas leads the way at $11,200. Victor Hovland, $10,900. Abraham Ancer, $10,700. Tony Finau, $10,600. Tyrrell Hatton, $10,300. Billy Horschel, $10,100. And Brooks Koepka, $10,000. When you see this board, talk to us a little about anything that stuck out to you, any golfers that you were quickly drawn to, any fade candidates. What did you see?
Yeah. Well, first, I'm just happy that we have this many names at the top, because it feels like it's been so long since we had a good field. And especially juxtaposed with what we just saw at Bermuda. It's like, okay, now we're talking. I think I expected Justin Thomas to be the favorite. My thing with Justin Thomas is I don't like him on positional courses because the driver concerns me. It's a little erratic, and yet he rates out as one of the better short course players. So to me, that just tells you he's aware that he needs to club down. Obviously, he did this at Sawgrass, which is so yes. Angular at TBC Sawgrass, and I was on him then, and I was a little skittish to do it, but I was betting a number.
On him also.
Yeah, like, you didn't really have a reason beyond the number that was there. You didn't have a reason to be like, yeah, this is going to be where Justin Thomas goes off. Anyway, you got to be a little nervous about him at the top, because I think we've been swinging freely the last couple weeks at whoever you want to bet outright, because you're not really scared at the top of the board. Justin Thomas was here last year. He came back. So I think he wants to win here. I don't think he's just here for a good time. I can't say that about a lot of the other top names here. Like, you always have to wonder what Brooks's intentions are at an island course, far removed from a major. So I think he's down here with Jenna, just trying to have a good time. It's a beautiful property. We are very close to Cancun. So I'm a little nervous about Brooks. I'm probably going to fade him. Subjectively, not based off the numbers. Victor Hovland, I think he's in great position to maybe not necessarily repeat, but we saw what he did last year. He's improved steadily since last year, and he comes in great ball striking form. The only reason he hasn't contended more has been the around the green game. And just based on what I saw on the course, I was getting up and down on a few of these holes, and like, I never get up and down. So I think it's like very favorable lies. It's a lot of like traps that are easy to hit out of. It's not like you're getting buried under thick rough around there. So I think poor around the green play is sort of excusable here, and you can get away with it. So maybe that's why he was able to win. We don't really know by looking at the lack of strokes gained data, but seems like a good fit for him. And then I saw we were both kind of talking about this on Twitter, but Abraham Ancer is the guy that I'm going to be betting at the top, and you know, we'll see what ownership comes to. I'm sure, like always, it'll be through the roof, but at least from a betting standpoint, I found a 27-1 on him right when it opened this morning. I think he's down to like six. He's as low as 16, as low as the second favorite in this field, which is kind of crazy when you look at how loaded this field is. But for 27-1, I think that's great value. Obviously, it's a Mexico homecoming for him. We just saw that play out pretty well for Hideki Matsuyama and not unsimilar circumstances. So I think having that home crowd behind you can be a good thing. We've seen how he's responded to that in the past. He's had great finishes here. Seems to always show up on these short courses, always known as one of the more reliable fairway finders in the game. And I think year over year, he's just kind of proving that he's rounding out his game. And now for the first time, he goes back to Mexico as a PGA Tour winner. And I think there's a lot of validity to getting that monkey off your shoulder or monkey off your back, whatever the saying is. I think the floodgates can kind of open a little bit. We saw this with Sam Burns. He kind of choked away a couple of times as soon as he won a tournament. It's like he had all the confidence in the world, and now he's just contending everywhere. So I'm confident, Nave, he let us down at the Shriners, but I think you can go back to him.
Yeah, I'm never somebody who plays Abraham Answers. So when he was number one in my model from an upside perspective, like that means something to me because I usually go on these shows and try to mention that I think he's one of the most overrated commodities that you can find in these tournaments just because we see golf Twitter. They're all over him every single week and it shifts the numbers. It makes DraftKings price him higher than what he should be. You get these like negative values on him in most of these tournaments, but I don't think that that's what you're going to get here. So I always run through the names from top to bottom to give an overall assessment. We have a few more choices up here than normal, so I'll try to keep it as short as possible. But yeah, Justin Thomas was the number one golfer in my model from an overall rake sense. He did drop to fifth when looking for just upside, which is a little discouraging for the best player in the field, but most of that comes down to him being inaccurate off the tee. As you said, Thomas was able to club down when he won the Players. I think that's something he can do here. So I wouldn't take him off the board entirely. And I do think Andy Lack was spot on when he tweeted 8 of Thomas's 14 PGA Tour wins have come between October to January. Now that's a weird stat, but what that shows me is all of them have taken place away from the mainland during that time period. And 2 have been on Paspalum greens. You know, he's the number one golfer in this field when given a slower surface. And as would be expected, he ranks first in my weighted proximity category. There's a lot pointing his direction when we remove one trait that he might be able to get around because of the length he can carry with his irons. I'm in agreement with you on Victor Hovland. I think he's a hot putter away from winning again. He ranks 3rd in my upside model. He's a defending champion at the course. He's averaged 3.3 strokes with his irons over his last 10 trackable starts. The driver's been just as good, totaling a positive strokes gain number in 21 of his past 23. He finally showed some life with his flat stick at the CJ Cup, and he tends to run hot and cold with that aspect of his game. He's followed up a positive showing on the greens with another the last 4 times he started a new streak. Answer's going to be the elephant in the room here, and I just kind of wish they would have made him the highest priced player on the board. I'm not sure how much it would have even mattered. But maybe you could have gotten a few DFS users off the play. You know, as I said, if you listen to this show with any regularity, you will know I'm never an answer guy because he's quite often overpriced for what his actual upside is for the week. But my model doesn't believe that to be the case here as he is the number one GPP player. And that means something to me when my model sees something that it never sees. And that doesn't incorporate ownership into the mix, but I'm struggling with what to do with them early on. I was lucky enough to find a 28-1 at one of my books when it opened, and that's obviously fallen since then too. But to me, he's starting to mimic what we see with Webb Simpson to an extent in the sense that the numbers sometimes are overvalued, but when he does like a course, all bets are off of how consistent he plays those tracks. 4 straight top 21s here, 3 top 14s, including a win during his last 5 starts in total. You can say the win was flukish, but you know, maybe that's all a player needs sometimes to get themselves over the hump, like you said with Sam Burns. Inside the top 2 of all iterations of my model, tournaments like this one where the top 3 golfers in price are also the top 3 on my board make it tough to avoid taking a chalky approach. I believe you can pivot elsewhere. Maybe you can stack 2 of them together and get more unique while still playing chalk. A Hovland and Answer start leaves you with 7,100 for your last 4 spots. You might start cutting it a little bit close there with the plays that you're making, but I'm kind of indifferent on the $9,000 golfers this week. I don't think it's a route that you must go by doing this, but there's value enough down the board where you can get unique with your takes. Finau's likely going to be the best contrarian pivot in my eyes. He's been erratic at the course with 2 top 16s and 2 missed cuts over his last 4, but I've noticed he performs better on these shorter tests sometimes than the bomb and gouge properties. That's not exactly what you would expect with his game, but the data spells it out that way too, ranking 5th in this field at courses under 7,200 yards. There is a route to stack him with one of the big 3 that can get you different very fast. I don't love the price on Hatton. It would be a different story if you swapped him with a golfer like Fitzpatrick and could take a shot at him in the 8,000s. But the early ownership is trending towards 10 to 15%. That's too high for me to consider. I like Horschel a little bit for cash at 10,100. 3 top 21s here in his past 3 starts. 5 made cuts in a row on tour. He ranks 3rd in my cash model. He's probably the safest target I can find that's not named Answer here. But he does have a negative trajectory for me in GPPs. We will see where the ownership goes, but I would want him sub 10% if I was going to ignore my model's advice. He has to be either positive in rank versus price tag or rank versus ownership for me, and that's something we're not currently seeing is the case at 13%. And Koepka, I agree with your take, John. He continues to be a stay away from me until I see something else. I mean, maybe I'll play him in majors. But other than that, I mean, you are just throwing a dart at a board and hoping to get lucky. I think he could be there for the wrong reasons. And I would rather play somebody like Scottie Scheffler in the 9,000s if I was going to dip down near the zone. So for me, Ancer Thomas and Hovland are my big three. I don't mind considering Finau if his ownership stays low. Horschel looks good for cash, and Hatton and Koepka will be virtually non-existent, most likely, in my builds. I guess so much for a short answer on that. I really did try to keep that short, but you know, it's the reason why I try to usually give such long answers on that is just because we are talking about the players with the best win equity in the field. I want to make sure that we discuss them as much as we can. Obviously, we can pick and choose darts lower than that, but let's move into the $9,000 range. Whereas I alluded to previously, I don't have a ton that is jumping off the board for me. Do you see this group differently? And if so, who are some golfers you like?
Yeah, I don't see myself having much exposure to this group, but I do want to get your thoughts on Aaron Wise, because 9,600 is almost unthinkable for him. But you look at everything that he has going for him right now, and it makes perfect sense why he's here. And I'm really curious to see what his ownership goes to, because a lot of people are just going to see the name and the price and not play him. And then a lot of other people are going to see the course history, where he finished runner-up last year, has another top 10, is coming up back-to-back top 10s, and has all of a sudden, when switching to this broomstick putter, become a very good putter. Completely flip the switch on what his reputation used to be, all by a simple equipment change. So he's kind of full steam ahead right now, and has really good course history as well. There's really nothing aside from like who he is historically. You look at just the stats on the page and you almost feel like you have to have exposure to him, but it's such a high price for him. I'm really curious what his ownership is going to look like.
Yeah, I mean, I can get around the price with him at 9,600. He's the eighth ranked golfer in my model. He's pretty much a neutral value from where he's at. The bigger problem I have is that he's right now looking to be about 20%, and I assume those numbers will drop a little bit. Usually the first look on, we're filming this on a Monday, usually the first look will be a little bit higher than where they end up going, and maybe enough people decide to get off of him for some of the reasons you just mentioned on it. But you know, the problem is, if I do like Ancer and I'm trying to start lineups there, I think one of the most popular starts will be the big three plus Wise, and I want to differentiate somewhere. So I would probably rather play Wise in cash if I'm going to go that route. I think it makes sense. I'm not going to talk anybody off of him in GPPs. You always can get unique in a build, especially in single entry or three maxes. I think that that makes some sense. If you want to play him there, you get different in other areas. I'm more concerned in these like large field GPPs, where if you're starting a lineup with Ancer and Wise, I think you're almost dooming yourself from the start, even if both of those guys end up doing fine. Like, it's just so hard to pay off the value when that's happening. I like Scottie Scheffler at 9,900. That's probably the one guy for me that I actually do think is a good play. My model thinks he should be 10,500. It might not sound like a huge difference, but it adds up when ownership is more or less the same with Hatton, Horschel, and Scheffler. You don't have to look any further than Scheffler being minus 132 in a head-to-head battle against Koepka to show that he probably slipped into the wrong range. I don't have any concerns with his past two showings at the Shriners or the CJ Cup. He lost heavily off the tee in one, pretty badly with his irons in the other, gained in those two categories during the two opposite starts. So, you know, that's one of those things where if he was continually doing poorly in one of those stats, I would be more concerned. But to me, this is just a situation where he wasn't clicking on all cylinders on those two tournaments. Off the tee looked good one time, looked bad the other time. I assume he'll put all the pieces together soon. And then the only other two that I have some interest in would be Patrick Reed and Shane Lowry. They're showing positive values as contrarian pivots. Both are negative for me in price versus rank, but I don't mind taking shots on them since it won't take much for me to get overweight at 5%. If those numbers increase, which I assume they will on Patrick Reed after his second place finish last week, I will reassess the board. But that's probably it for me in this zone. I will monitor the ownership of all those plays, but I'm not going in with the mentality that any of them need to be 40% owned in my builds. My goal would be to be above consensus in all spots. I'll likely treat Wise as more of a cash game play if I'm going to use him. But Scheffler, Lowry, and Reed is how I would rank the three. I will take us into the $8,000 range. That was a little bit of a shorter breakdown than the one we got before. So Cameron Tringali, 8,900. I like him. I think he's the natural pivot off of Wise if you're trying to figure out a spot to get contrarian. His course form doesn't give you an idea that his upside might be as high as Wise's, but Tringali is a different golfer this season than he's been in his career. I don't know if we ever end up getting the win on him that he deserves, but this is the type of setup where he should have his best shot at getting over the finish line. He ranks fourth in my model and inside the top 40 in all weighted stats I used, including grading third at courses under 7,200 yards. Matthew Fitzpatrick, 8,800, third-ranked golfer in this field in moderate to severe win, and is just a week removed from being the top-priced player on the board at the Bermuda. Fitzpatrick isn't necessarily a value for me on the surface, but as you said, like any course that mimics Harbortown is going to be one I give him a second look at. He's fourth in this field putting on slow greens, 17th at courses under 7,200 yards, and is maybe just a good GIR week away from having a shot to compete. Maverick McNealy, 8,500. You can always make an argument that McNealy might be better suited in cash versus GPPs, but I can make a strong case for him if I use my safety rating across the board. He's contributed two top 26s at the property in his two starts, and he should like the slower greens. Russell Henley, 8,200. Henley's going to be one of the most popular bets and DFS plays of the week. I'm a little surprised he hasn't found more success at the track in the past, missing two cuts and coming 29th in 2018, but he does check nearly all the boxes from a statistical perspective. If you're looking for any negative, 74th in birdie or better on par fives, 101st in strokes gained total on slow greens, maybe he's someone that is better outright bet than he would be for a DFS pick for all those reasons. But I'll monitor where his ownership goes and act accordingly from there. And then Mito Pereira, 8,100. You know, I believe PGA touts one of the presidents of the Mito Pereira fan club. So I will refrain from a breakdown and let John do his role. But start us off, if you can, with some thoughts on Mito and then anyone else you like in this group.
Yeah, the Mito bandwagon is large. And if I could ask for one thing, it would be if I could be the chairman, the line leader, the one pushing the movement, because I'm all in. I like to call it the Mito movement, the hashtag Mito movement. And I look at Mito Pereira, and it started with a little bit of hyperbole because he won, two or three times on the Korn Ferry Tour. A sort of weird late comeuppance where when he turned 25, he became this prodigal Korn Ferry Tour player. So he came up a little bit later. Not crazy uncommon for PGA Tour players. We've seen it with Xander. We've seen it sort of with Victor Hovland, where he wasn't like highly recruited until he got to college. So a little bit later on. I look at Mito Pereira stat-wise, and he is exactly who Victor Hovland is. They're almost identical in driving distance, in driving accuracy, in approach, ball striking off the tee, and their liabilities in short game. Mito is a little bit better around the green. Hovland is a little bit better in putting. This is all just referencing last 36 rounds. Finally, we have like what I would consider statistically significant data on Mito over 36 rounds. It started with, well, he looked good in the Olympics and he won a bunch of Korn Ferry Tour events. And now it's actually, okay, every single week he's top 10 tee to green. So I think it's legit. I believe in it. The putting is suspect and he's getting a lot of reps on these, not shot link grounds where we don't actually know if he's putting well or not. I'm assuming that he's not because he's just making a lot of pars and hitting a lot of greens. So it's just a lot of two putt pars, which doesn't get you super far here. You got to make a lot of birdies. I'm a little concerned about that. But at the same time, we're talking about past problem greens. One of his best finishes was at the Olympics, which sort of simulates past problem greens in the way that they're manicured, how smooth they play. So I'm optimistic about Mito. I will like Mito anywhere that Victor Hovland has won. So Mito goes to the Puerto Rico Open. I'm going to bet him there. That's not saying much because I've literally bet him in every tournament this year. I haven't bet him yet. I've seen a 60-1 on him. I'm like hovering over the trigger on it. I'm probably going to bet it again. Again, it's not a perfect fit, but I know he hits fairways. His distance is going to be a great advantage here, but it doesn't hurt. Approach is always going to be helpful. His around the green game is average or above average. And as we said, like this is kind of where you want to take your chance on your team no putt guys. So I still like Mito. I think it's a great number. It's a great price at 8,100, considering the upside, considering he basically is a Victor Hovland light, if you're just looking at the stats. So I will have to see what the ownership is. If I play him in DFS, I am leaning towards playing him once again. And God help me if I ever fade him and he wins that week. But it's looking like it probably won't be a FOMO week for me. If I go from the bottom up of the 8K range, I agree with everything you said on Henley. I kind of wrote him up as my spotlight player this week to keep an eye out for. I think the poor course history is unexpected because it does look like the type of course where you hit fairways, you hit greens, and you get hot with a putter. That's like literally Russell Henley's game. He won at Wailea, which I think is the number one comp course to this course, albeit it was a while ago, but he has great history there year over year. And you know, that's another course that's also exposed to wind. I think this is less exposed to wind, but it still does play a small factor. So I like Henley. I think he probably will be popular. 8,200 is short for him. He's kind of in a tailspin with the putter ever since he, you know, torpedoed his way out of the Wyndham Championship. And I think that'll get people skittish to back him as an outright. I can't blame them for that, but I have placed an outright on Russell Henley at 66-1. I can't feel too confident about it because I have seen him try to close out a tournament. But for me, I like a sweat. So if he's in contention, which he does put himself in a lot, I've at least gotten the entertainment value out of it. So I like Henley this week. And then Keegan Bradley. Here's one thing I'll say about Keegan Bradley. I tweeted out, you know, fairways gained is very important this week. And I wanted to see if there's any notable difference for guys who hit fairways on just in general, week to week versus strictly on short courses. You know, the thought being that if you're playing a short course, you can club down. Maybe you're not accurate with your driver, but you don't have to hit that driver every club, every hole. Maybe these people play in the fairway more often. Keegan Bradley goes from like 80th to number 10, I think. In fairways gained on short courses. So I think that's very interesting. He was not on my radar at first because he's been a little slow out the gates this season. But understanding that and seeing the way that he finished out at the Zozo, I think he could come into here with a little bit of momentum. So if I make three, five lineups, he'll definitely be in at least one of them. And the only other guy I would say in the 8Ks that I'm looking at is Matthew Fitzpatrick. See a 40-1 on him. I don't usually bet Matt Fitzpatrick, but he's coming. 2 weeks removed from a win on the Euro Tour. He was the odds on favorite to win last week, and now he's 41 at the MyCo Championship. I think that's just inherently good value. He's a guy that we know can get super hot with the putter, the way that a lot of the winners here have done. Good off the tee player, not going to wow you with his distance, not really going to wow you with his accuracy, but he always is consistent, hits a pretty straight ball off the tee, which is all you need. And just, you know, an all-around player. So I think 40-1 is a good number on him. I would take a matchup of him over a guy like Hatton, who's like $1,000 more expensive, and you're low on Hatton as well. I would agree with that. So maybe a guy that you cherry pick in matchups, if not now, right? But definitely a guy I'm sort of circling.
Yeah, I think Fitzpatrick's price is interesting because if he would have had a better finish last week, he could have creeped up to where Hatton is. I mean, you could roll reverse those two with their prices, and I think it would be perfectly acceptable. And I don't think anybody would find that big of a gripe with it. I mean, in fairness, Fitzpatrick would be too expensive if you did that. But I think this is more of the zone that he should be in. This is probably where Hatton should be. The most popular golfers, just to throw it out there in this range, Mito looks like he's going to be the most popular. 17% right now is what I'm seeing. Russell Henley, 15.5%. Maverick McNealy, 10.5%. Those looked to be the three most popular guys. I like your call on Keegan Bradley. He's a positive value in my model. I haven't made a decision exactly what I'm going to do with him, but I have no problems with him based off of that. And I guess the only other name I would throw out there would just be Sergio. He's less than 5% owned right now. He's one of the biggest model differentials that I can find on my thing when taking ownership into account. I mean, I guess of that group we've just named, who would be your favorite play from a DFS sense?
I think I will have exposure to Fitz, Bradley, Henley, and Mito in DFS, and probably just those four from the 8K range. And I would probably say I'm going to try to unbias. I'll take Mito out for bias aside. I like Henley. Honestly, I think he has really good top five potential at this price. I know the ownership's a little high, but there's a lot of options at the bottom of this board to differentiate. I think there's a lot more viable 6K players this week than I've seen in recent weeks.
I was going to say the same thing once we got there. So I'm happy you said that. I think this might be the week where there's the most 6K options I've ever seen. I guess for me, I would say the best outright bet would probably be Henley, mostly if you can get him at 60, 66 to 1. For DFS, I do kind of like Tringali. I just think that he's a nice, I mean, he's more expensive, but he's a nice pivot away. I think if you're going to skip the $9,000 section, I think Tringali can give you a lot of safety at less than 10%.
Did you get to watch the Zozo in Japan much?
I watched a little bit of it. I had some head-to-head bets when, you know, it's, I'm on the West Coast, so it's a little bit better time difference for me than most people.
Yeah, I mean, I was up till like 3 because I was sweating the Hideki outright. And it was very frustrating to root against Tringali because he takes the most effortless swing and it's in the middle of the fairway every time. So that definitely opened my eyes to him for this course because he seems to be able to hit fairways with his eyes closed. You know, hasn't been able to close out, but for DFS at this price, you know, you get a top 15, maybe even a top 20, and you're pretty happy with the value.
Yeah, I mean, I've reached the point with him in the outright market that I think he's unbettable. Like, if he beats you, he beats you. We're over 300 tournaments now that he hasn't gotten a win. So I think you're chasing incorrectly on that. But yeah, as you said, I think for DFS, and I wouldn't be shocked if he won this tournament. Like, I'm not going, I know that he's played 300 tournaments. It hasn't happened yet. It's likely probably not going to happen here. But if Tringali wins, I'm not going to be like, wow, that's the most shocking thing ever. He's fourth in my model for a reason. Like, this is the exact course I would expect him to find success at. So I think it's a perfect setup for him. I think it's a really good price at 8,900. And I think some of that lack of win equity, you see that in the pricing here on a site like DraftKings, where if he had a little bit more win equity to him, I think he's very easily in that high $9,000 range. But without that, you know, you get a golfer in the 8,000s and you get somebody at less than 10% owned because of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all right, as we move into the $7,000 range, I found it to be interesting how many golfers slip lower than I thought they should be this week. And, you know, there's some in the 6,000s, as we just mentioned, and there's also some in the 7,000s. And I will rapid fire off some names here shortly. But I'd like to hear your stance on the entire range before I do that.
Yeah, it seems like this is where all the chalk lives, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of names that are good names. And in the 7Ks, just given how bad the fields have been the last like month or two, we're used to seeing like rookies here, unproven guys, the guys who've never won before in the 7K range. And now you have like major champions and, you know, just like really elite players who just like had a cool end to last season that you can kind of buy low on here. So I think there's going to be a lot of ownership tied up in the 7K range. Maybe just something to think about to avoid a line of construction that leans heavily on the 7K range, because I could see a lot of people just peppering like two or three of these guys.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I mean, some of the names I will rattle off from here. Justin Rose, 7,900. I think that's GPP only. That's one way to get contrarian with the build. I don't think many people are going to play him, but I always like him on short courses with slow greens. Joaquin Niemann at 7,800. The putter has to turn around at some point, you would think. He's gained with his irons in 19 of his last 23 trackable starts. Off the tee in 33 of 37. The ownership's not as high as I would expect it to be. Let's see where it goes. Right now, I'm looking at about 10%. I think that's a really good number if that's all it gets to. If it gets higher than that, you can obviously reassess the situation. Seamus Power, 7,700. I know I keep stressing this point on the show, but Seamus is an elite statistical golfer and has been for the past year. My model picked up on it pretty much before anyone else did in 2020, but the results are starting to come around. If we're talking about chalk, Emiliano Grillo, 7,500. It's hard to say much bad about him on this track. Obviously, I could do without the popularity, but four top 15s in his last five tries. Ian Poulter, 7,500, and Brian Harman, 7,300 might be the two better under the radar pivots in this event. To put into perspective from a gambling mentality, Harman and Grillo are both minus 110 against each other in a head-to-head matchup. That's an excellent leverage spot in GPPs for someone that is going to be 15% versus 2% potentially. Well, I don't necessarily agree that Poulter should be a favorite against Seamus. You can easily find a way to put both into builds. Seamus is currently three times more popular than Poulter is for the week. I think, once again, we start running into some popularity when we talk about Dahman, Norlander, Pendrith. I think they make some sense, but the one of my favorite plays would be Kevin Streelman at 7,200. I have a proper price on him being in the mid 8,000s. He's a positive value for me across the board in all game types, although the real value is coming from his upside in GPPs. Streelman ranked 10th for me from a statistical perspective and is 14th in that weighted proximity range I ran to somewhat mimic this event. Ownership will be more of the decision for me here when I'm trying to figure things out. But Harman and Poulter are the two I like best with virtually no ownership at this point. Strowman, Power, and Neiman will all find their way into builds at a reasonable ownership percentage, and I will likely let ownership play itself out for the rest of the group before making any final decisions. But that does take us into the garbage picking section of the slate, which might not be as much garbage picking as it usually is this week because of all the quality choices that we can find. And maybe it's because I get a kick out of using some of the features of my model that I put into place to find incorrectly priced golfers down here. But as you said, John, there are a lot of potential plays. So I will let you go first, and then I will take us home to wrap up the show. What caught your eye?
Well, honestly, right off the bat, Guido in the 6,900s, I wasn't even thinking about him because I assumed that he would be, you know, high sevens. But just to see him down in the sixes is really interesting. He was in contention going into Sunday, caught awful weather on Sunday, super random weather, shot, I think, 77 on Sunday, but he was right in the thick of it going into it. And I think he led the field last week in driving accuracy in really tough conditions. So if he can carry that into this week, continue to be accurate with the driver, the approach game has been a little up and down, but you know, we've seen this guy contend. He's a good player. He's almost on the Ryder Cup team. So I think that's a crazy low price for him in this field. Definitely one that caught my eye immediately. And then after that, I'd have to go down the board a little bit. I know Denny McCarthy is 6,200. That one like almost threw me out of my chair. Great short course player, guy who usually relies on the putter and hasn't even had that going for him much. You know, he's due for a little positive regression there, especially when we go to Pass Palom. I do want to have exposure to some elite putters this week. As we said, I'm really favoring a lot of these like team no putt guys. And I do want to complement that with some elite putters. At 6,200, you're getting one of the better putting pedigree players in this field. He has good results at the Honda, which I actually think a much more difficult test than this, probably a winning score at half of what we would expect at Mayakoba, but one that really puts a lot of pressure on your tee shots. And he had one of his best finishes of the year there last year. So a lot to like about Denny McCarthy. Adam Svensson is a guy, not a lot of data on him, Canadian guy, looked pretty good last week. Usually not a good putter, has shown in his career that he can get really hot with the irons. 6,300 just seems like a crazy price for him. And Kyle Stanley is a guy who has okay history. Obviously, you know, we know what he is short game. He almost never gains with his short game. If there's ever a tournament where he possibly could gain with his short game, it's a course like this that's so easy around the greens and flat surfaces. The ball striking's been so, he's number two in this field strokes gained ball striking last 36 rounds, and he's 6,300 on a course that we've seen poor putters kind of pop. So I would say to start, those are definitely the guys that jumped out the most to me.
Yeah, I think when you get down into the $6,000 range, you're trying to find elite skill sets, players that can separate themselves from the pack. I think a guy like McCarthy can make putts. That obviously makes a lot of sense. If we're just looking at like what some of these players have done in their last 24 rounds, Svensson ranks 13th in approach. Stanley ranks 11th. If Stanley ever can just be neutral with the putter, he might actually be able to win the tournament. So I like all those calls. I also like Tom Hoagie at 6,900. Third place here last season, four top 36 finishes over his past five starts on the PGA Tour. Fourth in this field when it comes to weighted proximity. I think Ryan Palmer certainly makes some sense at 6,900 if he stays under 5% owned. The current form continues to be very questionable, having failed to post a top 40 over his past four starts. But I think he's too good of a golfer to be in this range. There's a ton of missed cut potential, but the ceiling can get him a top 10 because of his iron play. Charles Howell, Scott Piercy, they aren't names that necessarily pop for me, but they've combined for seven top 26s at the property over their past nine starts there. I also really like Guido. I think that that's a weird price tag for him at 6,900. I was like, my model thinks accurate for him should be 7,600, which once again, it may not sound like that big of a difference, but all of a sudden, I mean, we're talking $700 price tag difference. It opens things up and the ownership doesn't seem to be crazy with him at this point. So I think he's just a really good GPP play that's coming in under the radar and too cheaply priced. Steven Yeager, 6,800. Top Corn Ferry producer last season. All the love for Mito. I mean, that was the guy who finished number one. He had multiple wins there. There are a ton of metrics that are starting to stand out for him if we gradually shift the model to a higher emphasis on scrambling and overall scoring versus just par five birdie or better. The par five birdie or better drops him, you know, outside the top 40. But if I remove that altogether, all of a sudden he becomes a top 25 play at 6,800. I really like Chris Kirk at 6,700. It didn't quite work for me at the Zozo when I went overweight on him, but this is another potential opportunity to grab him. He's the largest model differential for DraftKings that I have. Rory Sabatini, 6,700, has been respectable here over the last 3 years, providing three straight top 55s. He ranks ninth in my model on slow greens. I probably should stop with the Ryan Moore thing every single week, but 6,700, yes, I've been burned by him, but he's going to be less than 1% owned. I don't think it hurts to put him in a few lineups. He's inside the top 20 for me from an upside perspective. I mean, once again, this is another guy that's GPP only, but you're not going to have to play much of him if you're mass building lineups. Graham McDowell, 6,600, is currently the biggest advantage I have in ownership versus rank. The data is extremely hit and miss for him on my spreadsheet, but he ranks inside the top 30 as a golfer that is less than 1% owned. Those are the leverage spots I usually try to dream of, and they're hard to get. You don't very often get that example of that. So I think McDowell's a really good GPP leverage play. And then just a few outliers or flyers that I like. James Hahn, 6,400. Brian Stewart, 6,300, who might have found something on Friday at the Bermuda. He's missed a couple cuts in a row, but a short course is kind of what I typically always want to play him at. Probably the only course I want to play him at. Trey Mullinex, 6,100. I think if John is right that this plays more off the tee than I believe it will, he ranks fifth in this field over the last 24 rounds and fifth in my two-year model. He should be considered nothing more than a dart throw under 1%. But maybe he fits into a lineup where you go with a different approach where you're a little bit more driver heavy with it off the tee with that. But that will do it for the DFS section. Before I let you get out of here, I know you gave us some of the plays you have, but what have you bet so far this week? What are you potentially looking to bet?
Yeah. So far I bet Answer 27, Henley 33, and Streelman 100. I will probably add three more bets. I am, as we said, like my finger is like hovering over the Mito button. I can pick that at any time. I don't know what I'm waiting for. It's basically on my card. You mentioned Justin Rhodes. What was that?
You just don't want to bet it multiple times. If you wait till the last minute, you're not going to end up with 10 bets on him all of a sudden.
that's true. The earlier I bet it, the more time I have to reload. So that's
exactly.
You mentioned Justin Rose. I never bet Justin Rose, but there's a lot of comps that he popped at. I think Colonials is what I think of most recently when I think of Justin Rose. He's had some good finishes there. That's another angular, important off the tee, course, and he can get really hot with the putter, as you mentioned, especially on the slower green. So not a guy I usually go to, but he's had some good Euro finishes recently. I think he's sort of re-energized after a poor season last year, and definitely a crushing a Ryder Cup snub. So he might have a little motivation to start the new year. So I'm interested in him. I haven't pulled the trigger there yet, but I think I see a 60 on him. I'm considering. I think Griot and Knox are guys that I like a lot. They're going to be popular, basically the same sort of guy. I think those two and Aaron Wise are really like the same player. Aaron Wise is a little bit hotter right now, and he's so much shorter on the odds board. So I think you're getting a pretty good value there, whether you want to go DFS or a placing bet on those two guys. Definitely reliable off the tee, which again is what I care most about this week. So I may go there. And then as a flyer, I like Henrik Stenson, who I have forgot he was playing this year, but I looked on the Euro Tour and he strung together two top fives and I think a top 30 in his last three starts on the Euro Tour. You only play Henrik Stenson on the shortest courses. I think last I saw, he doesn't even carry a driver in his bag anymore. So this is the type of course that, you know, he wants to feast on. If he ever has a chance, it's here. I don't know if I'll get there on an outright, but definitely a guy that I think can contend. The longest guy that I'm thinking of from like a top 40 standpoint would be Tyler Duncan. He's gained strokes off the tee in 10 consecutive starts. Gained stroke is on approach and back-to-back, and it's coming off a 14th finish at Sanderson in his last start. So kind of coming in with good form, a really bottom of the board player, but has some good upside. Guy who hits fairways and, you know, can keep himself in play. And I think it's really an open field. If you're in play off the tee, anybody can really get hot. So I like the upside on him.
Yeah, I like the Duncan call. I hadn't looked too much into him, but he's one of the biggest climbers in my model when looking for safety. So I think as a top 40 play, you could do a lot worse than that. I'm curious to see what that number ends up being for him. He's looking about 2% owned at 6,400 right now. As far as my outright card, I will release the final wagers on my podcast, Better Golf, that I do for Win Daily Sports. But I'm in agreement with you as of right now. I have Answer. I have Henley. I have Streelman. I'm trying to make some tough decisions between Rose, Fitzpatrick. I might add Guido. I saw 160 on Guido. I think that's just way too large of a number. But I'm going to go through that, make some decisions. Obviously, that show will release on Tuesday. You can get all the answers there. You can look at the model that I will release on Monday nights when you can attach your own weights to it. You can see what I have to get a general feel for that. But, you know, John, thank you for coming on the show this week. Please let everyone know one more time where they can find you.
Yeah. And thank you again. One more time. You reminded me Fitz is also on a short list. He may make the last cut, but we'll see. I have a couple of days to mull it over. You can find me on Twitter at PGA Town. You can find my website at thepgacup.com. And, you know, I write a couple of articles a week. Once we get out of the fall swing, I'll probably be a little more active. But for now, it's kind of a preview and a sort of a values article for these sort of bottom of the board guys that we talked about. It's a lot to go through, especially this week. It's a lot to sift through. So I try to shortlist that and talk about my favorite guys. So be on the lookout for that. I'll be putting an article out tomorrow.
Well, I really appreciate this, John. You can find me on Twitter at TF Sports. You can find this show at Be The Number Pod. As John just said, you can find him at PGA Tout. Good luck this week to everyone investing money into the Worldwide Technology Championship. And I really hope we can do this again soon together, man. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Anytime.
All right. Good luck this week, guys.